Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation I'm hoping helps your business grow. So many of you may have seen the episode about my company, Fullscale, making the Inc. 5000, and we are really proud and happy to have done that. It was our first year eligible. Now, with that, we wanted to highlight other companies here in our hometown of Kansas City. That's right, Startup Hustle is from Kansas City, which, by the way, is in Kansas and Missouri, for those of you that didn't know. I blow people's minds when I break that news to them. But so many companies go from startup to Inc. 5000. We had quite a few amazing companies here in Kansas City make the list. And that's what we're going to focus on this entire week of Thanksgiving, because we are thankful for all of the people at our companies that have helped us win awards and do great stuff. And that's what we're going to get into today. I've got someone from company number 134 on the list of 5,000. That's really high up on the list, everyone. Before I introduce today's guest, today's episode of Startup Hustle is powered by Fullscale.io. Hiring software developers is difficult, and Fullscale can help you build a software team quickly and affordably, and has the platform to help you manage that team. That's my company once again, and I'd love to talk to you more about it. Go to Fullscale.io to learn more. With me today, I've got Steve Bernstein, and Steve is a partner and co-founder at CrowdFarm, and that's Crowd, but P-H-A-R-M. And there's a link in the show notes where, you know, I want you to go down and click so you can learn more about what they do. Steve has got some really interesting stories and information. I'm looking forward to the conversation that we actually started having quite a while before we hit record. So we're ready for you today. Steven, welcome to Startup Hustle.
Well, thank you, Matt. And congratulations to you, too, on your company. Inc. 5000 is a big deal. And
yeah.
It's neat to see so many people in Kansas City represented.
We're trying to keep up with you, man.
Yeah.
Trying to keep up with you. You know, let's just dive right in, because you have such an interesting backstory. And I've had the privilege of meeting many of the people that are involved and key members of that story. So I'm going to go ahead and just hand the mic over to you, and let's hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, thanks. I think it's a fun story. I tell people, when I tell the CrowdFarm story, it is an entrepreneurial story that's filled with successes, failures, moments of doubt, and now redemption. So I think it's a neat story. And if you don't mind, it kind of starts with how I grew up and where I grew up, including Kansas City, and then into what I do right now, and then into CrowdFarm. So
Lay it on us. Yeah.
So I grew up in a marketing and advertising family. My dad is an entrepreneur, Bob Bernstein, and founded Bernstein Rain Advertising Agency, one of the largest independent consumer agencies in the country. And my childhood, I guess, was a little bit unusual in marketing, because my friends used to tell me this. They'd say, "You're the only house that we go over to when we watch television and the commercials come on, you're totally quiet. But when football games and everything else on, you're talking like anything." And I thought that's how everybody grew up. I thought everybody was tired or quiet during commercials. And I guess that's not true. But And yeah, I grew up in Kansas City in a marketing family. And when I tell you this one thing, Matt, I'll tell you this, and it's probably the only thing people are going to end up remembering from me, is in 1976, my dad represented McDonald's. We've represented McDonald's for 55 years. And they were trying to get kids into the restaurants. And I did what every 10-year-old did. And for breakfast at that time, I ate cereal for breakfast. And I used to put the cereal box in front of me and read the same cereal box over and over and over again. My dad actually used to be angry with me. He used to come down and say, you know, he'd see me reading the same thing and say, can't you read your homework or the newspaper while you're eating cereal? Can't you read something other than that stupid cereal box? And I'd say, no, I'd keep putting that cereal in my mouth and turning that cereal box over and over again. But from watching me eat that cereal and read that cereal box over and over again, that's where the creation of the Happy Meal came from in 1976 when I was 10 years old. And I love to tell that story, although when I tell it, I say that's probably the only thing you're going to remember from me. But hopefully that won't be true when I get into Crowd Farm. But anyhow, it's kind of a neat story. So anyhow.
Yeah, I went through the same thing, and you just brought this very vivid memory of me sitting there like staring at the back of a box of Cheerios.
Yep.
And so my mom went through the same pain and anguish that your dad did.
Yeah.
And started, and that went from us staring at the back of the Cheerios. So she started doing vocabulary words on index cards.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we would have a new one every day. And my sister's smarter than I am, but we have a large vocabulary.
Because of that.
Yeah. So we'd have a different word every day. And if we wanted to earn our allowance at the end of the week, we had to know all five words and be able to describe them. And you know, but you talk about like filling that space and that time. Now, I mentioned before we hit record that I had the privilege of listening to your dad give a presentation, and you and he are both very humble with the success, because he's, you know, he worked with Sam Walton, mm-hmm, and McDonald's and beauty brands and did a lot of different things like that, and was a very, very, very interesting speaker. And why was I even there? Because he was winning an award with the other Matt Watson, my yep, co-founder at Full Scale. And yeah, I just being growing up in and around entrepreneurship is a big thing for so many people that have become entrepreneurs. I can imagine what the Super Bowl must have been like at your house then. It was like,
oh, that's a religious event.
Yeah,
it still is a religious event. Yeah. You know, the game is something, but we're completely quiet and all the analysis goes into the commercials. But
so how did that, you know, I think that I'm a big advocate of teaching your kids about what you do. And my father was an attorney, which at his own firm. So was an entrepreneur of sorts. But I remember like so many things. I am not an attorney, but man, I kind of think like one on a lot of days. How did that experience growing up? And also here's another thing too, is like, that might've cast a big shadow or big expectations on, I mean, the Happy Meal is a big deal. Who hasn't had a Happy Meal?
It's kind of a big deal, right? Parents either love us or hate us for that.
Right.
But you know, entrepreneurship and being around entrepreneurs has to rub off. I mean, because my sister is an entrepreneur, my brother is an entrepreneur, my wife is an entrepreneur. My dad's dad, if he was here, he'd be telling the story. My grandfather was an entrepreneur and not a very successful one, but he never worked for anybody. And he was one of those old school guys who used to have all of his money rolled up, everything he had rolled up in a rubber band in his front pocket. And that was my grandfather. But I think it has to rub off. I think where it rubs off is just the willingness to jump and take risk, you know, and know that sometimes you're going to fail. Not everything you do is going to be a success. And I think you see that being around other entrepreneurs. You know, you mentioned my dad's experience and my experience with Bernstein Rain, our advertising agency. Yeah, we got an opportunity to be around Sam Walton of Walmart, Ray Kroc, McDonald's, Henry Block of H&R Block, Wayne Huizenga, Blockbuster. I mean, you can't be around those great entrepreneurs without it rubbing off. And I always say there's two things that were the biggest things that rubbed off on that. You know, they were all very different, but the two things that they all had in common is they all had this great ability of finding an opportunity. You know, they would see an opportunity, big or small, but they'd really focus in on that opportunity. And the second thing was just focus. They would stick on that opportunity no matter what anybody told them. You know, Sam was told when he started Walmart, he was with Woolworth, you know, which was the big five and dime at the time. He brought the idea to them. I want to open up in small towns. They said, I don't think that's going to work. Well, he stuck to it, and boy, he stick with it. And they became the largest retailer, largest company at the time in the world. So it's the ability to find opportunity and sticking with it and jumping, you know, taking that risk.
I like to say jump and then build wings. And the thing that I've learned is that nothing will make you build those wings faster than the impending doom of hitting the canyon floor.
And I
do advise that you have the materials to build the wings before you jump, or at least know where to get them.
But it's
that necessity. And then also solving a problem that's worth solving. In regards to crowd farm, and once again, there's a link in the show notes. All right. So to give a little background, and, you know, Watson and I did an episode, and we'll put a link for this in the show notes too, about what the Inc. 5000 even is. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'll refresh that for a second, being the first of a series of shows that come out. So Inc.com. or Inc. magazine is pretty widely distributed, and they do an award for privately held companies, meaning you can't just go to the New York Stock Exchange and buy stock in CrowdFarm or Full Scale, or at least yet in any of these things. And they look at a 3-year period and they gauge your revenue growth over that period. So for us, we were at like, I can't even remember the number. It was over 700%. It was like 732%. That put us at number 878. Now with that, there's, you know, roughly 7 million companies that qualify. You do have to let them know that you are interested in being considered, but a hell of a lot of people put that application in. And so, you know, so now being at 134, that's a big deal. I mean, that's high, because one thing you realize when you look at the list is the air gets pretty thin in a hurry. Like, you got to get some big numbers in there. And so, before we get into that part, like, what's the problem that CrowdFarm solves as a business that has made it so scalable or popular or accelerated that growth?
Yeah. Well, it's CrowdFarm, which is a healthcare pharmaceutical advertising agency. It does everything that a healthcare pharmaceutical agency would do and you'd expect, but it has an engine behind it that's completely different. And what that engine is a worldwide network of today 4,700 members. It changes, it's dynamic, because every day we're getting new members in 110 different countries. And we have the technology of a platform that we use to reach out when we have a marketing challenge. We reach out to that network and we put the challenge out there, and they come back with answers. And it's that on-demand expertise that is unique to the way marketing is done. And it used to be, I've been in marketing all my life. As we mentioned, we grew up with it. And, you know, for years, everybody has been saying, we need a change. We need to find a new way to model agencies and go after creative challenges. And clients were saying that forever. People were always trying. And even though clients were asking for, when you put the new thing in front of them, they'd say, I know that's the new thing, but not so fast. So when I tell you a little bit of the history, we started one called Boom that was a predecessor of CrowdFarm. And I think it was a little bit ahead of its time. And so it did not succeed as well as CrowdFarm has. And I think perhaps the market caught up and said, okay, I know we've been asking for it. And then when you showed it, we weren't ready. Now we're kind of ready. And it's that gig economy and being able to use freelancers instead of full-time people as on-demand talent that's really been the thing. So
okay. I'm assuming that advertising pharmaceuticals has a heavy amount of regulation around it.
It does. And that actually is what creates the opportunity. So, let me tell you the CrowdFarm story and then I'll get to that part. So Bernstein Rain, which we talked about, is a consumer agency, a leading consumer agency. About 2008, we picked up the PetSmart account, and we pitched against great agencies and we were very thrilled to win it. And we were representing them nationally. But the first meeting I had with them, and this is very true, any marketer listening will say this is the case. When I first met with them, they were very honest and transparent. They said, hey, we're very fickle. We love you guys. You're great. But in 3 years, we're going to want a different agency. I'm like, okay, great. Thank you for being transparent. I hope it's 5 years, but okay, 3 years would be fine. Sure enough, 3 years into it, we did a good job, Bernstein Rain. They said, you know what? And this sounds really trite today, but it's true. It was about 2011. They said, we need content, which everybody says now, but they might have been a little bit ahead of their time saying that. And they said, your traditional agency model, it doesn't work. You know, you take too long to get things done. You cost too much. We're not getting out of the box thinking. You got to do something different for us. Well, I've been watching crowdsourcing start up about that time, and they had too. And they said, we'd like you to create a crowdsourcing model for us, and we'll stick with you if you do it. We love that you're entrepreneurs. We love the relationship. We just don't like this old model anymore. So I created a company called Boom, and Boom IdeaNet, and it was in the consumer space, and it was specifically to work for PetSmart. And so we started a network of about 200, I mean, it didn't start at 200, but it became about 250, 275 people around the world, but primarily in the United States, who were creatives. It's the same idea we're talking about. You put an idea out there, they were willing part-time to give you back ideas, and you compensate them for that. And we ran that model for PetSmart. I do want to say one thing in just definitions here. When we talk about crowds, we definitely exist. CrowdFarm and Boom before it existed in the crowd space, but we're really not a crowd. Crowd means open source, means anybody can jump in, anybody can contribute. We're actually a network, but people don't think of it that way. A network means they're vetted. We have NDAs on people, they're contracted. Mm-hmm. So they're really not a crowd, but people think of us as a crowd.
That's what we do at Full Scale.
Yeah,
and that's the main thing for us is going through 30 applicants to maybe give, and then key the word maybe, give one job offer. But in order to provide service, so we work with high-level tech companies and companies similar to yours that have intellectual property and need NDAs and non-competes and stuff like that. And when you go to hire someone that's not in the United States, the question is what level of accountability do you have? So we literally had to open a business and a legal business in the Philippines and, you know, and do all that. And the main thing, people are like, well, so you sell technical services. And I said, no, we sell peace of mind.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's very similar to what you do, because the vetting thing is, well, and I don't ever like to compare our business. People are like, well, are you like Upwork? No, not at all.
Yeah,
you can go hire anybody in any country for 3 hours and pay them hourly. That's not what we do. We provide dedicated people that become a member of your team. And that's like, and guess what? So that disqualifies us from working with 90% of people that might think they need a computer programmer or a developer or whatever.
Yep.
But that's not what we do. And they don't want to be in those marketplaces either.
Yep.
So so with that, I'm assuming that kind of, so you obviously working with pharma, you made yourself, I want to say, kind of a small batch operator, because you're not just like an open, like you're not, I'm not going to sign up at CrowdFarm. I'm not the kind of company that you deal with.
Yeah. Well, you might sign up, but we're going to put you through a test and we're going to vet you, and you probably won't make the list, but
as a client or as a service provider?
As a service provider.
Okay. So, but that, no, because I don't, the marketing people we have are, they just work for us and we don't provide those services.
Right.
Because I think part of creating a business similar to the ones we have is also understanding, okay, this is what we do and we're really good at it.
Right.
And then, you mentioned the focus part.
Right.
So, man, that took me a long time as an entrepreneur to figure out, because I think entrepreneurs like to chase shiny things. You did just tell me that you started a startup in order to provide service for PetSmart.
Yep.
Which that's also how businesses get started.
Yeah.
The thing is a lot of entrepreneurs, I give people this advice all the time because I've learned it the hard way. You can't chase every shiny thing.
No, and that's hard because we do see the opportunities.
Oh God. Yeah. And I get that a lot. People are like, oh, you're like an ideas guy. I'm like, yeah, it's terrible.
Right.
They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, it's terrible. Like the noise in my head is excruciatingly.
Yeah,
it may define insanity.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Matt. And that's probably one of the internal challenges is you got all these ideas out there. You want to do them, but you realize success comes from focus. And those are two opposite things.
Yeah. So realize what you're good at and what your business is good at. And what you guys are doing follows the advice I give so many entrepreneurs is pick one, maybe two things and be a triple plus at it.
Be
really good at it. And you focus on that because the clients and the relationships and the accounts that you really want are looking for that.
Yeah.
They're not like, hey, give me the cheapest.
Right.
And I hate the word cheap.
Right.
Because when you think of cheap, you think of flimsy,
right.
crappy, whatever.
Right.
We're still affordable.
you're a value.
Yeah.
You're efficient, but you're not cheap.
There's a huge difference there. Right. So, yeah.
Well, that story, so that's the success. I said we have success in the story that Boom was successful for PetSmart. It ran for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. It was good for them. It got them the content they wanted. It was financially good. It was good for us. Boom was very successful. But then we ran into the failure. The failure was that if you built your business on 80% or more of one client, you're going to have a problem. And we knew that.
Yeah.
But we were keeping up with PetSmart and it was going great. But one day they said, you know, we're done. And that's what happens in our business. And we could get into that, but there's probably not enough time for it. But so we said, oh shit, we got to go out and do something. So we said, you know what? We're perfect for agencies. We'd be perfect for advertising agencies because we know them well. We can help them scale up and scale down, which we know is a problem for agencies. And let's go out and try to get all the agencies in the world. Great idea, horrible execution. We did not do well picking up agencies. Agency CEOs would always love us because they'd say, oh, I see, it's going to help save us money. You'll manage our talent. As soon as we got to the creatives in the agency, they'd say, well, we don't want you guys. You know, well, we have our own freelancers. I have my own network. I don't need any of that. And so it basically stopped. Advertising agencies, and I'm one of them, are inherently paranoid. We are cheap. You know, and we always think that people are trying to steer our clients. So it was not a good market. And we started burning through the money that we'd built up in PetSmart rapidly. And I say rapidly, we were successful. So it lasted for about 2 or 3 years. But this is my first moment of doubt as we couldn't pick up clients. I was thinking, I'm an idiot. I should, as soon as we lost PetSmart, I should have closed the whole thing down, taken that money and done something else with it. But I believed in the model so much. This is that stuff where you see the shiny object. I couldn't let go. I couldn't let go of it. So I then started putting my money in and more of my money in. And I ended up working for an agency that was in the pharmaceutical business. I don't know anything about pharmaceutical or healthcare, but he was somebody who I went to school with, a guy named Mike Myers, and he was in Saratoga Springs, New York. And he had an agency called Cross and Wild that was pharmaceutical, but he didn't have a creative department. So we started working for him and we were making a little bit. Again, I'm still failing as Boom, but it was really working for him, really working for him. So then Mike, who's my co-partner now in CrowdFarm, he came to me with the idea. He said, and again, we've known each other for a long time. He said, this is really working for me. Is it working for you? And I said, well, on the Cross and Wild side, it's working. You know, it's working supporting you, but it, you know, it's not as great as I want it to be. He said, well, why don't we do this thing together? Because one, you're going in the consumer world, there are tens of thousands of agencies, and there are even some who are doing crowdsourcing. But in the healthcare market, there are not. There is nobody doing it. And we've got an opportunity to just go into that vertical and have specialists. And that gets on the question that you asked before about, and even what the business you're in. Not everybody can do this. And in the healthcare, it's heavily regulated. There's a lot of specialists needed in every disease state you can actually think of. And so Mike said, let's not do a network of 270 people. Let's have 5,000 people in our network, you know, because we can have an expert in every type of disease that people are looking for. We can have experts in that. And let's build out our platform. Let's make our application. Let's make that outstanding. You've got a shoestring thing. Let's make it outstanding. I said, okay, let's do it. We decided to do it together. So now I have a partner and Mike and I built CrowdFarm. He was running Cross and Wild. I was running Boom, but we brought it together into CrowdFarm. And the story in the end is great, but I'll give you my next moment of doubt. It is hard to bring two companies together. You've heard this before. Mike and I have similar philosophies, but we have different ways of going about things. And my second point where I was doubting myself that I did the right thing was it was becoming too very difficult culturally to bring the two companies together. We had real struggles in that. And it was working, but I said, Mike, I don't know if I can keep doing this. Maybe it's better that you run the thing by yourself because you're driving it. It's my model, but I don't know if I can handle these conflicts. Well, he convinced me not to get out of it. And I'm glad that he did because, again, I was in love with the model and I wanted to stick with it. And eventually we got over the hurdles of bringing culture together. But I'd say it took a good year, maybe year and a half of some pain of, you know, he approaches things a different way than I do. The people who I brought in who worked with me, they were used to my style. The people who he brought in were used to his style. And those didn't always work together. And but once we got an understanding that we're all in this together, and once we went through those pains, it actually worked very, very well. And so that is where CrowdFarm came from. And now today, CrowdFarm is what we talked about. We have 4,700 members worldwide. We're in 110 different countries. We have not needed to borrow any money. So when we get into financing, we've been very fortunate that we started, you know, with a model that had clients. And so we only had, the model was to have very few full-time people and then to rely on freelance beyond that. So low fixed costs, high variable costs. And so it's been a great success story from there.
Yeah, and that's a, you know, it's an extension of the marketplace concept, which I've spent a lot of time talking about on this show and the history of the show. And I want to have a couple comments about that. Before I let you know what those are, I want to remind you that finding expert software developers does not have to be difficult, especially when you visit fullscale.io, where you can build a team quickly and affordably. Use the Fullscale platform to define your technical needs and then see what available developers, testers, and leaders are ready to join your team. Visit fullscale.io to learn more. I think we're a lot, our platform's very similar to yours in the regards that, like, but, you know, we vet our clients actually at an equal level that we do our talent.
Yeah, that's the best place to be in.
Well, so much it's about, you know, who you're working with. And I want to talk about the marketplace thing because because of my role at Fullscale and then Startup Hustle and as an author, a lot of people seek opinions and advice. I'm sure you get the same thing. And a lot of people have a marketplace that they want to launch. And so when you're talking about like CrowdFarm or the same thing with Fullscale, which are more exclusive marketplaces, like, mm-hmm. you know, you guys only want a specific type of client. And I would imagine that if you're not that type of client that you've learned to say no.
Yep.
Same thing with us, but essentially what you have then is a marketplace. You have buyers and sellers. Well, we're the sellers, but the problem with these things is if either side of that is not populated or sparsely populated, it gets really hard to run the business.
Yeah.
Like buyers aren't in places without sellers and sellers aren't in places without buyers. And
yep.
I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs that have a marketplace type concept, regardless of what it is, whether it's services or any of it. And they have not given enough consideration to the difficulty of populating both sides of the marketplace.
Yep.
Was that difficult at CrowdFarm?
Well, it happened naturally because of Mike's expertise. Again, okay. He was our largest client in Boom. And
do you agree that that's a problem with the marketplace?
Absolutely.
Type thing? And like that is a marketplace.
Oh, absolutely. And you asked me earlier, maybe what was our reasons for success? I mean, there are three. We touched on one. The model is something that clients like. But the other thing is the marketplace. And I feel like I lucked into it, but Mike, my partner, worked very hard to be in. And it is pharmaceutical and healthcare. Pharmaceutical and healthcare is doing very well now and doesn't look like it's going to slow down because we're all aging and we're all needing more prescriptions and medicines and therapies and all types of things to keep things going. And so our marketplace is really every drug manufacturer who wants to launch a new product. And you just watch television today, although it's not just on television, you can see how many new drugs are being launched all the time. And it's a great marketplace for us. So, that's one of the keys to success.
And you don't have to give away the trade secrets,
yeah.
But what were a couple things or what are some tips that you could give? First, I'll lead with one. I tell people, because a lot of times it's a software startup, you know, and they want to bridge the gap between buyers and sellers somewhere.
Right.
And I say, you need to be prepared to give it away for free.
Yeah.
For a while.
Cause yep.
You have to, especially if it's empty, like, why do I want to sign up? It'd be like, you don't go to Craigslist, maybe antiquated at this point, but you don't like our eBay or any of these things.
Yeah.
If no one's selling anything, if you go to put in XYZ product in eBay and there are zero results.
Right.
You go look somewhere else.
Right, right.
And the problem with that is it's hard enough to get a buyer or even a seller into the marketplace in general if
yeah.
they just jet out the door right after. So like that, like I said, that early adoption of like, say, I'm not going to charge you buyer or seller fees.
Yeah.
And the problem is though, is that means you have to pay, you have to engage in marketing to get people in and
yep.
you got to be ready to eat, you got to be ready to eat your own expense report.
Yeah.
For a little while to get people in. I mean, that's one thing. That's one way to get people in where there's some others that.
Well, Matt, I agree with you totally. You know, you can have a great model. You can have a great marketplace. But the first question that somebody's going to ask is, well, show me who you've done it for before. And you might hit the unicorn who wants to do it, be the first one with you. You might. But I wouldn't build a business hoping to find that unicorn. So I would say you got to build your book. And yes, the first few clients we did it scraping by. And we'll still, even today, if it's the right client, we'll do it at very low margin and maybe even not make money on it just so that we can put it in our book. Because case studies mean everything, not just for our business, for your business too. Show us who you've done it with before. Show us the advantages that you're telling us about. Show us how it actually worked in the marketplace for somebody else.
It's a chicken and egg problem we all had as 23-year-old entrepreneurs, or even just people seeking a job.
Yeah.
Everywhere wants experience. How am I going to get experience if no one will give it to me?
Yeah.
I'll go out and figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, I've had a lot of people that have said, dude, I'll come work for you for free.
Yeah.
And I don't ever take them up on that because I don't think that I'll pay you anyway. But you just talk about wanting to get exposure.
Right.
And I go back to there's something you said at the beginning of the conversation. You're talking about growing up around some pretty influential entrepreneurs. There's something we say here a lot that we try to be cognizant of, is that until you've seen winning, it's often hard to win. And there's a value to that. And some of the things that just even it could be, you look at look at a team like the Kansas City Royals, which quite honestly is a terrible team that rarely wins, but they have some good moments or whatever. But you look at teams like that, and they keep around role players and people that set a good example for those that are coming up, and that's to show you winning and to show you professionalism and how to get it done. And I think that for anybody that's wanting to get started, we talk about, okay, so how do you start up and then go to Inc. 5000? Get yourself exposed to some of it, or be ready to just fully immerse yourself and be ready to fail a lot.
Yeah.
And dude, I fail all the time.
Yeah.
And I sometimes have people that'll say things, and the same thing with Matt Watson, because we were joking as he might us. Because by the way, Matt had 3 companies in the Inc. 5000.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. But with that, he'll be the first person to tell you that he fails all the time.
Right.
Like and he's a software developer at heart, which is like literally scientific failure again and again and again and again. You're like, I'm going to try something else. But I mean, that's a guaranteed thing. So if you had to talk to, what would you tell yourself 20, 25 years ago?
Well, it's probably the same thing I tell myself today. And you probably would say the same thing. Yes, I failed a lot, but don't be afraid to fail. And I still take failure horribly. I have a horrible time failing.
I take it personally on some levels for myself. I mean, just like, I don't like losing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what would I tell myself too, in addition to not being afraid to fail? I think it's what you said. And it's what I think I started with, maybe by accident, but surround yourself, be around other successful people, be around other entrepreneurs, realize what they've done. It's all right to model people. In fact, it's great to model people. There's a lot of people that I admire. In fact, I'll tell you a little bit of boom. VML, who's done wonderfully well here, and their leader, John Cook. I think John's a great leader. And I went, before I created Boom, I went to a speech that he gave for the ad club. And they were asking him, okay, you've done a great job with VML. What are you afraid of next? And he referenced a scene in Jurassic Park. I don't remember which of the Jurassic Park movies, but it had the dinosaur in it that was evolving. And now it had new skills and all that. And John said, that's the thing I'm most afraid of, is something that doesn't exist today. And that really stuck with me. And I haven't had a chance to tell John, but that's one of the things that really inspired me to go into Boom and therefore CrowdFarm. And so it was modeling people like John Cook and VML, but being around other entrepreneurs and seeing how they stick to an opportunity and focus.
People ask the question, I tell them the same thing, and they'll say, well, how do I get around? You just ask.
Yeah.
It's true. I've literally made a living doing that. But there's a key component to that, because please do not contact me and give me a coffee invite. I'm not coming. I'm not going to drive all the way across town to meet a stranger in a coffee shop to talk about something and then spend the time driving back home. But if you make it convenient.
Yeah.
So if you want to get help from people, make it easy for people to help you.
Yeah, that's true.
But I mean, that's just a key thing. And I was talking about this to someone yesterday, that you know, I'm 47 years old now. And I think as entrepreneurs age, we all look back at our stories and we're like, man, why did that person take an interest in me? Why did they even care? It would have been so much easier to blow me off. But it's that someone else took interest in them.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And with that, you know, there's people that get my attention, and I feel kind of beholden to transfer some of the knowledge and experience.
Yeah.
But I will say that all of them. So when I say make it easy, this is, if I wanted to reach out to you, this is how you do it. Say, hey, Steve, I'm a big admirer of all the things that you've done. And I know that you have so much information and knowledge that you could pass along. I'm interested in some of that. Can I come to you? Can I, you know, or whatever. And yeah. Then I'm going to, you know, if you tell me, you're like, you'll find that ask,
yep,
will get responses. And because otherwise it's like, if you try to make people go out of their way,
yeah,
to help you,
yeah,
you're not going to get as much help. And it's the same thing. It's like, I've run into a lot of stuff. I actually had someone want my advice on a pitch deck once. And I said, well, there's a lot of problems with this. And they said, well, will you fix them for me? No.
Yeah.
No,
right.
I'm doing other shit, you know, but.
And who are you again?
But, well, right. It's not even that. It's like, no, it's not my thing. But if you told me, if I really wanted your help, your input, your advice, and you said, okay, I'll meet you at 3 a.m. on Sunday, I'll be there.
Yeah.
I'll be there. And yeah. I'll say, how much time do I have? And, you know, and can I bring anything with me?
Yeah.
And if you do that, you'll find that a lot of people will be really receptive. And I always point out my friend, Sandy Kemper, you probably know Sandy, and he's the founder of C2FO. And I remember, you know, Sandy's got 10 million things. He was in here not too long ago, and 25,000 companies onboard at C2FO a day.
It's crazy. I saw
25,000 reasons to do something else other than talk to me. But I remember I needed some help and some advice, and I emailed him, and I was like, hey man, I could use your help. I could use your advice. And tell me, you know, when, where, whatever. And he replied in 2 minutes and said, come on by.
Yep.
And I was like, shit. All right.
Yeah.
And I went,
yep,
you know, I like dropped what I was doing and
well,
just
you
went
would
over
for
it.
Sandy. Right.
But he gave me advice in that what was only about a 15-minute meeting that actually he gave me a blueprint that I ran with. And you talk about like no funding. So we didn't ever sell. We don't have any investors in Full Scale, but we were trying to bridge the gap. And, you know, Sandy gave me advice. He's like, you create your own venture debt. And honestly, at the time, I'd never even heard of it. But you create your own lending pool. You don't have investors, you have lenders, and you pay them an amortized return. And in order to
don't give up part of the company.
Yeah, you don't give up any of the company. Yeah. So it's non-dilutive capital.
Yeah.
And it accomplished exactly what we needed to do. And then of course I gave him the first opportunity to be one of those lenders, and he became one.
That's great.
But I came proper and I came prepared. And with that, I wasn't like, oh, hey, you know, lend me some money. I had it all prepared and I came back. And with that, you know, give the same people that have helped you opportunity to help again if that comes up with
you. Yeah. You know, coincidence or maybe not, I grew up with Sandy. We went to the same high school. He was a year older than me. So we know each other well. Yeah. And talk about another person to admire. And Sandy's somebody whose ideas are so far out there. Most of the time, I don't even understand what he's talking about, to be honest. But
dude,
then he makes,
me too.
But he makes them happen.
I give him a hard time because, you know, he loves Startup Hustle. He's been on three different times. And he's one of the few people that I let send me a list.
Yeah.
Here's five things that we could talk about. And I always give him a hard time because I'm like, dude, you're making me do a lot of homework. Like, you want to talk about like the macroeconomic effects of small business arbitrage and, you know, like all these different, I'm like, dude.
But yeah. Matt, you got to do that if you're going to keep up with Sandy.
I did. And that's another thing. He's like, well, I mean, these are things I thought would be interesting. And I want you to be prepared. And I'm like, yeah, I was.
But
I give him a hard time about that.
Right.
But that's the point is with that is like that he didn't have to take time to talk to me. I mean, he had no vested interest in my success at that time or whatever. And literally in a very, 15 minutes changed the shape and the trajectory of
what
we did. And we turned around. Like we created that venture debt program within like 10 days and achieved about $700,000 in funding from people we knew within the next 10 days after that. So, you know, rather than, and you look back at some of these things that, that change your path or your trajectory and some of that. And like, I'll never forget that.
That was one of them.
Up, and we even talked about that the last time he was here. And, but the key was, is I made it easy for him to help me. He didn't have to go anywhere. He was sitting in the same seat when I got there that he was in when I sent the email.
That's awesome.
So he didn't have to move to help me. Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a key thing. And, you know, I think that that's important.
Well, it's one of the reasons your startup hustle works so well. You know, entrepreneurs, some of them may be humble, some of them not, but every entrepreneur likes to talk about their journey and is happy to share it,
I've actually, because this comes out 5 days a week, so many people are like, that must be a lot of work. I'm like, well, not necessarily for me, because you know, we have a great support team that our request was that I need to sit down and hit record and then hit stop and be able to go back to doing other things. But
yeah,
people are like, well, where do you find the guests? I'm like, it's easy. They're like, man, I tried to do a podcast and I couldn't find any guests. I'm like, well, did you ask? Cause people really love to talk about themselves.
Of course.
And you know, it's also, I mean, that obviously got a lot easier as this platform got a little bigger. And
well, we talked about, you know, starting a business too, even starting this. Of course, I knew of Startup Hustle. I'd listened to it a few times, but before as a guest, I went back and looked how many you had. And I thought, man, if I could be included in that group, that's great. So again, looking for your case studies, even on Startup Hustle, to say, okay, well, I'm more than happy.
I'm glad you came in, because at this point, we've had a lot of people that, you know, so we'll have our fifth birthday.
That's amazing.
At Startup Hustle this year. And Startup Hustle is older than Full Scale was.
So yeah.
Watson and I started Startup Hustle because we wanted to tell the real story of entrepreneurship, and we came in hot. Episode one is like what Startup Hustle was going to be about. And episode two is titled "Getting Funded Sucks," because you know we figured like someone needs to tell people that like it's the real deal with it, and that entrepreneurship is not easy, and it's not for everyone.
Right?
I mean, it is truly not for everyone, and I think you need to resolve yourself to whether it's for you or not.
And you have to have an appetite for risk.
Yeah,
and not everybody does.
Did you always know you wanted to be an entrepreneur? Because I did.
You know, I think I did too.
I can't remember. People ask me that a lot. They're like, when did you know you wanted to become an entrepreneur? My answer is I don't remember a time when I didn't.
Right. Well, again, I was around my dad, who is a true entrepreneur. He started with nothing. And so he was always creating things. So we all grew up. I have two other siblings who I mentioned. We all grew up always trying to create something new. What's the next thing new? And getting frustrated when you couldn't, you know? I think I always wanted to be an entrepreneur and create
some of that feels genetic now that I have kids, because my daughter especially is like a super creator and salesperson. I remember when she was, I think it was her fourth, she was four, and we gave her a lemonade stand for Christmas. And of course she wanted to sell lemonade. After I have a video of this somewhere. And I remember asking her, and she has all these cups of lemonade. She's like, do you want to buy some lemonade? I'm going to say, I do. How much is it? And she says, $5. I said, that's a lot for lemonade. She said, and literally I realized what an amazing salesperson she was. Like, and I never taught her any of this. She goes, yeah, but it could be, you're never going to know if it's the best lemonade you've ever had if you don't try it.
Wow.
And I was like, holy shit. Wow. A 4-year-old just outclassed most of the salespeople that I know that are adults, because that was an excellent way to handle an objection.
That's awesome.
You'll never know if it's the best lemonade you've had if you don't try it. And I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
And that was, I also took her to one of Lauren Conowitz, who's a regular co-host. And make sure you tune in for Lauren's shows. They're great. She's been a weekly host for over two years now. But I took her to an Innovate Her fundraiser event, like a pitch competition. And there was eight female founders that presented and wanted to raise money. And I took my daughter with me, and she was like barely, that was right around that same age. And she was chomping. She wanted to get up and give a presentation. And I was like, you know, you're not ready for that. And she goes, well, I want to start my lemonade stand. I said, well, you need money to do that. And she goes, well, how do I do that? Because they're asking for money. I said, go ask people for money. She went around the room and she raised like $9. But
she knows the process.
I pointed out was amongst the top money raised that night.
That's funny.
But she went out and asked, and right. You know, it was kind of like, I actually had to slow her down, because I was like, I'm going to maybe have to give some of this. I tried to give it back, and the people that gave it to her. They're like, no, that's great.
It sounds like she's great. Got a great start. I have a daughter too. She told me yesterday in marketing, and I'm impressed with her. She said, Dad, I've listened to you a lot. You don't sell just products and services as an advertiser, as a marketer. You sell feelings. Mm-hmm. And I go, Isabel, that is right. I go, you are right on.
It's like the peace of mind comment.
Yeah. Yeah. I go, can I borrow that? She goes, yeah, you can borrow it. Yeah. So anyhow, so I'm borrowing my daughter's. I'm not helping you sell products and services. I'm helping you sell feelings. Man, she has got marketing down.
Well, that's the point that I had earlier with the peace of mind commentary. Cause you know, with what we sell, people are worried. Like you look at building software, it's like, well, okay. Would you want to take apart my Rolex and put it back together? Because I'd feel really uneasy with that unless I understood your experience or skills as a watchmaker. And if you're like, yeah, but I'll figure it out, I'd be like, maybe not the right thing for me. So, you know, software engineering is kind of the same thing. If you put the wrong person in and they can really muck up like a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
So that is always rattling around in people's minds. And then you also have preconceived notions because a lot of people believe that, well, in America, we all think that America does everything better than everyone else, which by the way, isn't always true.
Right.
And that's not an unpatriotic comment. That is a realistic comment.
Right.
But they've had a bad experience with a company in India or maybe even the Philippines where we're out and whatever. They're like, well, I don't want to go through that again.
Right.
So the peace of mind thing is without peace of mind, nothing else really has much flavor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you lose that peace of mind, especially as an entrepreneur, if I could sell you a healthy glass of peace of mind, that'd have a pretty damn high price tag on it.
Yeah.
Because that's a tough thing to get.
Yeah.
And so if you can find ways to do, like you mentioned, or even like feelings.
Yeah.
Because like I would think in pharmaceuticals, it's like that could be a bland kind of thing. Like here's something that I'm having a hard time even pronouncing.
Yep.
For the name of your medication, then it fixes this. If you can sell the feelings for how someone's going to react if that pharmaceutical successfully accomplishes, you know, I mean, if someone has eczema,
right,
they hate that.
Right.
And that contributes to a lack of peace of mind. But what are your feelings if you're like, wow?
Well, you just hit on the magic of our network. Yeah. I mean, so we have people from all different walks of life, from all different backgrounds, from all over the world. You get all those contributing to what they think the feeling behind that product should be. And then you can find the right one. I love saying, by the way, it's a little bit of a jump off point. But in marketing, I believe the good answer, the winning answer is out there somewhere. It's our job to find it. Mm-hmm. So again, why wouldn't I want thousands of people trying to find that answer instead of just a few?
Yeah. And that's so we're here in the studio next to this giant metal Startup Hustle logo, mm-hmm. which by the way, was crowdsourced.
Cool.
That was not a 99 Designs thing.
Yep.
Like 5 years ago.
Which that's what we're not. Yeah. But yeah, anyhow, but you got a good one
for that because I spent a couple $100.
Yep.
And the whole idea of the crowdsourcing was they call it a contest. Mm-hmm. But I wanted a lot of different concepts and that stood out right away.
Yep.
Like right away. And 5 years later, we get a ton of comments on it. People want the stickers, the shirts.
Yep.
And, you know, you look at it, it's a dollar sign and the dollar sign is wearing a set of headphones,
right?
You know, but the crowdsourcing, I mean, there was dozens or maybe even hundreds of people that put in on that.
Yep.
And I think when it comes to creativity is a great thing.
Yep.
Cause you never know where that good idea is going to come from. It could come from a 4-year-old,
right?
It could come from a 44-year-old. It could come from an 84-year-old.
As long as we vetted them.
But true.
Right.
Well, you know, thanks so much for joining me once again with me today, Steve Bernstein, partner, co-founder at CrowdFarm, Inc. 5000, number 134 in the 2022 list. Proud to have you in Kansas City. And I'm embarrassed to say that this was your first time on. You know, that's part of why we looked at the list and we're like, we've joked that Startup Hustle here in Kansas City has become a rite of passage for many people. We've had people that have come back a second and a third time.
Well, now I'm in the club. It's like hosting Saturday Night Live, right? I get my jacket if I come on so many times. Yeah. Is that what happens?
Well, we can't tell everyone, you know, what the secret handshake is.
Okay.
So if you want to apply to be a guest, go to startuphustle.xyz and fill out the form. And good luck. It's a long list right now. But
do I get the secret handshake when we sign off?
Yeah, totally. Okay. Totally. And cool. Let's go ahead and do that, man. I'll catch up with you next time.
Okay. Thank you, Matt.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.